man.
We screwed it all up. Well, I apologize for not capturing the introductions in the recording, but we'll get from here on. Yes, I've got a screen to share.
Oh, man. There you go. And we'll figure out how not to miss recordings again.
Yes, that's dumb. Okay, I need to make sure I find the relevant tab here.
Is that against policy?
It is. We're supposed to record from the very beginning. That was a...
No, no. What I mean is calling yourself...
You can mock yourself. You just can't mock others.
Really?
Otherwise, all appropriate humor would be dead. We must preserve the right to mock ourselves. Okay, so what I'm showing here, we talked about on the RFC process conversations last time that it would be useful to have an index of the RFCs by status. So there's a bit of Python that Daniel Hardman and I have written that automatically takes the contents of the RFC repository. Here's like concepts, etc. And then displays them in an index. There's a couple updates that need to be made. The code folder is not yet being included because that wasn't here yesterday when I was writing this. And I'm going to do a couple things like sort these by number and some other things to improve this. But this is the URL that it will be. It's this markdown file right in the repo. And then we will be committing updates to this as part of the regular RFC maintenance process. So there's different phases here. I should add a hyperlink to what these actually mean. But proposed is a very early stage. Accepted means we're in the process of discussing and doing all those things. Adopted is the fact that it has become a standard through implementation. And then superseded are more or less archived RFCs that have been replaced by another one, and they link to the ones that replace them. So we can adjust this page as needed. So the form will likely be updated to make improvements and corrections. But in the meantime, that is here. So the things that I want to bring this to your attention so that we can talk about these sorts of things. The first one I'm going to bring up here is DIDCOM, and that's not the right one. This is the right one. Okay, so, and I just noticed that the number on this is out of sync. I'll have to go fix that. But here's the DID communications, this explains, this is a concept document, but it explains the basic idea behind DID communications and what it involves and the goals and the things that are here. So there's a bunch of background here for relevant information in DIDCOMs. We also have message ID and threading, which describes how to identify messages in a way that is JSON-LD compatible, and how to refer to other messages in a thread-like manner, so that when you have protocols that have a state that happen over a thread, you can understand which message is replying to and things like that. The other thing that I want to draw attention to is decorators here. And decorators are common message elements that can be included. That includes like threading and message ID. Actually not message ID now that I think of it, but other things. And that's when you see something prefixed with a tilde, that's a decorator. So that's here as well. And so these are the ones that are here now. We encourage your participation. The process document here, here's the lifecycle diagram. And then there's a section here on how to use GitHub issues to discuss concepts in the RFC. And that way we can have a sort of an open place for discussion about that, as so that those things can be updated and tuned as they go. We have no issues so far, but those are the issues we're going to experiment with, using those to be able to have the conversation, since we're trying to not have things pile up in pull requests. And so that's the process here and the overview. And we very much want your participation and feedback. To help us get through these processes, I will go ahead and make sure this is the code. Never mind. So that's the code that generates it. We'll have additional folders besides concepts as described here in the general document. We've also described the features folder. And we can create any others that we need. But that is here. We will be, we're in the process of taking RFCs incubated in Indy and introducing them here to the RFC process. And if you have hypes over there in Indy that that are relevant to the Aries project, then we invite you to help that process along. And we'll do our best to kind of keep up and make the appropriate amount of progress that we need. So that is that's the status of Aries RFCs. Are there any questions?
Just wanted to add, if any of you guys make a pull request, I try to check it daily. If you want it to move through faster, just ping me on Rocket Chat, me or Daniel or Sam, and we're able to get them through much faster than we were in Indy now.
Specifically, if you're not updating the status of the document, then it's really easy to move it through the process. Because it's considered just an update. So when you're updating the status, that invites a copy. But if you're just getting it in there so that we can talk about it and everything else, then that's really easy for us to approve. We just check that the basic things have been followed and that the basic process has been followed and it's all aligned. Like the right goes into the right folder, for example, if it's a concept or a feature. And so it's very easy for us to approve those PRs.
And Sam, I think
so. So in case we want to file an issue or just to raise a discussion, to initiate a discussion on using a different crypto algorithm, for instance, Salsa instead of Cha-Cha, would this then be the right place to raise these issues or create these issues and start a discussion?
This is definitely a place you can. We don't actually, I believe, have the wire level RFC here yet.
No, it hasn't been moved over, but do please raise that issue because that is something that we want to discuss. And I have thought about that, so.
Go ahead and raise the issue, and then you're not gonna be able to tag it to a specific RFC, but that's okay. And then we'll work on getting the wire level hype moved over into an Aries RFC. And that way there's the target here to discuss.
All right, thank you.
Perfect.
So, Sam, one comment I had was what this will allow. So in the previous version, in what we were using in Indy Hypes was basically to be able to contribute to a, in this case, an RFC, you basically had to do a pull request against a pull request, and it got quite complicated. We can now just do a pull request that will be accepted if you want to contribute more information or add more to it. That does create the possibility of, an argument happening via pull requests. And so the maintainers will sort of step in the middle of those. So if some person puts something into an RFC and then another person takes it out and then the other person puts it in and so on. So we want to break those cycles and make sure that just becomes conversation as opposed to done by PRs. But what we do want to do is have people clarify, extend, correct typos, whatever, improve the documents that are in here very easily with pretty low overhead. So keep that in mind as you look through these.
Yes, and we do invite those corrections to any of these. The other thing that I'll mention is that we often ended up having, because of things getting held up in a PR state, they were semi-unlinkable because they were linked through the PR. By accepting these and actually having numbers, we have a static link for the thing for ongoing discussion, which is also a helpful element of this process. But yes, if you have discussions and there's something that may be controversial, we encourage moving those to discussion and issues rather than having a war via PR. That's not very fun. So please do that. And as maintainers, we'll do that. We'll step in if we need to, but I don't anticipate that being a massive problem. Other questions about Aries RFCs?
It would seem a good idea to get that pack and unpack one in as quickly as possible.
Yeah, Kyle, do you have time to do that relatively soon?
Maybe this weekend. I'm heading back to Des Moines, so I'm a little bit busy for the next few days trying to get ready for that. So.
I might be able to slide it in tomorrow morning. So I'll try and get that one in.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question about the page. Some of these documents used to be Hyperledger indie documents. So would it be useful to link them back to what was their Hyperledger indie number? And also, will they be removed from the repository of Hyperledger indie?
They will not be removed from indie, but they should be updated to include a link to the new one when accepted. So that and that's the superseded status over there. We're going to say, hey, we're not removing the document, but we're sending it over here. And that way we preserve that. When you do move a hyper, we should link to where it came from. But that's not that's only from a historical sense, not really future. If someone wants to go and see what it used to be or any discussion that linked to the previous one, that's available.
So Oscar, I'm trying to do that on the ones that I've moved over. The one that Sam just clicked on didn't show it, but I think some of the other ones actually say this supersedes, you know, such and such a pull request. Oh yeah, here we go. So right here.
Yeah.
So I'll try to be more consistent about that. That was my intention, is to do that. If you go look at Indie Hype 002, I can't remember if that one is, was that a pull request? Oh, this one was already merged. So
yes.
The merged ones I haven't done, but the pull requests, what I've done is I've gone in and I've updated the final, you know, leaf commit of the pull request with a little message that says this document has been superseded by Aries RFC such and such, and I've linked to it. So I'll do the same thing when I'm in the middle of doing a whole bunch of cleanup. It's fairly time consuming, but that's the intention, is that they'll be cross-linked both directions. Maybe you could just pull up one, Sam, one indie hype that's been a pull request that's been closed, so I can see if everybody likes the way I did it.
Do you have one in mind?
77 or 78, I think, have both been closed.
You said 77?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is closed, and if I scroll down to the bottom.
Yeah, scroll down to the very bottom of it.
I vote yes.
So there's the link to the superseding thing. And then if you actually look at the latest version of the document, so look at this pull request and look at the files that have been changed and go to the latest version of the README. Yeah, just view that guy. And then tell me if you think this is good enough.
It's a little subtle, Daniel. I'm concerned that someone might. I'm kidding. yes. We can either say obsolete or superseded.
Oh, I'll change it to superseded if you want. That was the terminology we were using. Yeah. I forgot about that.
But this is super effective. So yes, I vote yes. Is there anyone that has a suggested improvement to this process or doesn't like its effects?
I just want to say thank you, Daniel, for doing all of this. You've done a lot of cleanup work and maintenance on this, so I figured that should be called out.
Well, I wish I had some automation that would make it a little faster, but so far it's been a lot of hand editing. I've got 35 branches in my Indie Hype repo that represent 35 different documents that all need this, and that's just the ones that aren't merged.
Is that all just the stuff that you were working on before we started this?
Yes.
Yes, we very much appreciate your work. So I think what you're demonstrating here, Daniel, is awesome as far as bidirectional linking of the documents. And if you do notice, if anyone notices something out of place or that is incorrect, like, for example, I noticed that there's a number inconsistency in the document versus the title up here. Please file an issue about that and tag one of the maintainers in it. And we will go ahead and get that corrected.
Just make the PR. Don't file the issue.
Just take the PR.
Even better. Yeah, just make please make a PR. If you find yourself unable to, but you notice something, then please ping a maintainer. Otherwise, we will gladly accept the PR that fixes this.
Daniel, is it worth sharing your process so that and we could have a list of ones to be grabbed and moved over. People can grab them, so share the work, if not the automation.
Sure. I could write a little Google Doc and post it on the Aries channel and say, here's the process I'm following. I'll cross-post it on the Indie channels, too.
You mean you don't want to make that hype and then debate it?
Nice.
Please, no.
I'm loving
how... Don't spend more time on that.
Despite the fact that it's onerous to move this stuff, I am loving how much faster it is to make documents show up and have a meaningful status. So this was a huge improvement. I'm so glad we've streamlined the process.
Yes, and thank you for everyone being involved. And there was a flurry of work the end of last week, which was fantastic because I was low on time. So I appreciate everyone's involvement there. Any other comments on RFCs before we move along? Okay, I'm hearing none. If there's future thoughts, then please reach out, and I'll stop sharing.
So for those new to the call, there are a lot of accepted hype, indie hype, or indie hype repo. There's a lot of accepted ones, and then there's a whole pile of pull requests for ones that are in process. So if you do want to start a dive before it's all been moved over, you can do that. There's quite interesting ones. Okay.
There's a non-one-to-one overlap. Some of the indie hypes don't apply to Aries, and those will be staying there. It's only the ones that apply to the Aries project that will be moving.
Yeah. Okay. Next up on the agenda, credential exchange protocol. There's not a lot of update. I will share the presentation I've been using. So I've been facilitating the conversation. This is a hype generated by the Evernym team, and they've been maintaining it. Hold on, what am I sharing now? One sec. Yeah, sorry about that. Got confused. So there's a presentation. I can paste that into the chat.
I see a black screen.
Okay.
There we go.
Give me a second. Okay. You see it now?
Yes.
Okay. So this is just I've been facilitating conversations on several calls. You can see that there was a couple of calls back in the past. I just use this document as a way to present what's in the hype. Second page, there's a link to the actual PR89 that's there. Here's a bit of a history. It has not evolved much since this last update. This was the last major update. There's just been minor tweaks to it. A number of us in the community implemented a version 0.1 of this. So the idea was we needed to implement something immediately. We didn't want to disrupt the conversation going on in the indie hype. So we did a 0.1 version of it and let the other conversation go. This was used for an IIW demo by three or four participants in the community. Mm-hmm. And so that's that link. The only issue that's come up recently is the question of whether the protocol is too complicated, and in particular has too many message types. The basic, for those interested, they can go into the details either in the hype itself or in this presentation. There's some pictures of it. So this, for example, is the format of the credential offer message type. So there's the message family, it's the credential exchange message family, and then this is the credential offer itself. These are the fields within it. This is where we are right now. However, since our last meeting, the hype has not been updated with the changes that we've asked for in this. So that's still to be done. But Oscar and the team at TNO has raised the question that the hype is too complicated. And so Oscar, I think basically your idea is to remove credential offer and credential proposal, and presentation proposal to remove those messages. As I understand it, we cannot remove credential offer as Indie SDK is right now, because in order to do a credential request, you have to do a credential offer. So you have to start with the issuer to holder.
So that's a cryptographic requirement.
Right.
Yeah.
So I would say that we need to keep credential proposal, because it allows the holder to initiate the process as opposed to the issuer. So otherwise, it has to be the issuer start it. I guess the credential request could come in. Well, and no, it can't, because the credential request requires some cryptography from cryptographic elements from the credential offer. So the proposal, I think, should remain so that the holder can initiate the process.
With regards to this, Oscar, remember this morning how I was talking about the agent can be programmed or yes. To support multiple methods? This is one of the ways where the semantic value of it could be kept and just programmed into the agent, or it could be pushed up to the human layer by the agent, depending on how it's programmed.
Just a clarification.
Mm-hmm.
So if it initiated by the issuer, it is an offer. And if it is initiated by the holder, it's a proposal.
Correct.
That's just the name of the message type.
I understand. I'm just trying to clarify that. And that means it's an either or. And yes. then the response.
It's, well, it's the proposal. Not strictly, because if, for example, you're correct to the large extent, except if an issuer offers a credential and the would-be holder would like to negotiate on that, they could respond with a proposal, which is prior to receiving an updated credential offer, which then comes to a request. So the credential offer and proposal together create a negotiation, the ability for negotiation to take place during credential issuance.
Yeah, I don't think the word proposal conveys that meaning.
Me neither, but we couldn't find a better one. If you've got one, we'd love to hear it.
Sure, let me think about it, and I'll you know if I have one.
Okay. We would appreciate that.
So that the gentleman who just said something about this being a negotiation. So in other words, the offer and the proposal can coexist only because the holder says, look, you know, I need something different.
Well, so Stephen, can you go to the previous slide?
Yep.
So the offer and the proposal are two directions of a link. It's worth mentioning that you can't just have a proposal. It needs to enter into an offer. So so this is prove at the bottom, but it's this functions as the holder, right? And so the offer goes from issuer to prover, and the proposal goes the other direction. If the holder initiates the process, then based off of a known offer or something like that, then the issuer responds with the offer that is then used in the request. An offer must be sent, but it can be started by a proposal or it can be countered by a proposal. And this loop actually happens, the credential, the offer proposal loop happens until the holder receives an offer that they're happy with, and then they actually request it.
Okay.
So, I still agree with you that proposal is a terrible name and that we should find something better, but we haven't been able to find one yet.
When a proposal is used to to suggest an alternative to what has already been offered, then calling it a counter offer would make a ton of sense. But since it can also be the first message in the sequence, calling it a counter offer when it's the first measure or first message in the sequence doesn't make a lot of sense. So we were kind of scratching our heads. And I think Oscar's proposal would, let me use the word suggestion since proposal's overloaded here. Oscar's suggestion would be to eliminate the cycle here. So in a simplified cycle, you'd have credential offer goes to credential request goes to credential. There wouldn't be any of the cycle. Is that a correct summary, Oscar?
Yes, Daniel, thank you.
But how do you express the intent, Oscar, in that event? How does a holder initiate the credential, retrieving a credential offer?
Well, as I have learned, my mental model of how things can work is different from how things are currently working in Indy. So I can share with you my mental model, but then I'm likely using a language that is not matching with the things that we already have. So I'm not sure.
So in my mind, I think some of the confusion is that, you know, in the real world, you know, an issuer doesn't initiate the process, right? Somebody, you know, an individual says, hey, I want a credential, right? And we don't really have language for that. It just sort of somehow out of band, the issuer knows that a credential is wanted then starts the process. I think that's where some of the confusion is coming in.
Yeah, I think the problem here is symptomatic of credential request is used downstream. That's the intent a holder is expressing to a would-be issuer to please send me a credential. But the clincher in ZKPs, because they're an interactive process, is you can't make a credential request for a ZKP-based credential without having an offer, because the offer contains cryptographic elements required to be present in the credential request. So I think that's potentially where we're having confusion, is that first message from the holder back to the issuer. We're using the term credential request, but perhaps we need to explore changing that name.
That may fall better into the naming of like credential setup, which is more in line with what it's doing. It's actually just a setup phase to get the ZKP stuff done.
This is not a vote one way or the other, but just for everybody's clarity, the credential offer is a protection for the holder. What it does is it requires the issuer to make a cryptographic commitment to the schema that they're going to be using in such a way that they are not able to embed other information in the credential. The party who's going to receive the credential is able to test whether or not there is extra information that's going to be inserted. So that's the purpose of the credential offer. The credential request exists because the blinded link secret has to be supplied by the holder. And that's why those two messages exist before the actual credential is given. If you didn't have either of those requirements, if you said, oh, we just believe that issuers will never try to abuse a holder and collude with verifiers to put blind information in there that the holder doesn't understand, then you could eliminate the credential offer. And if you said, well, we're not using link secrets, you could eliminate the credential request, and then you just have a one-step process. But that's why those other two steps exist.
I think also to just also clarify on top of Daniel's point, the credential request must come after the credential offer as well.
Right.
You can't switch the order. So before that question is raised, there is a state required there that the issuer must submit the offer to the holder or the would-be holder before the credential request is submitted back to the issuer.
Right.
Perhaps it's worthwhile going through the workflow using an example. So age over 21. So, you know, this is happening after did authentication. So And maybe it's without a zero knowledge proof, actually, example might be beneficial.
So the age over 21 would not be a good example because you wouldn't get ever a zero knowledge credential that just says you're over 21. You'd get a zero knowledge credential that says, here's your birth date, and then you would use it to generate a presentation that says you're over 21, which is not the workflow we're looking at. This is not a presentation workflow. It's only an issuance workflow.
Yeah, and this is why it's overly complicated because there are many different steps. And so, I mean, I think if you just can simplify it and actually like it'd be beneficial and maybe not having a zero knowledge proof.
Why not?
This doesn't look like it's a zero knowledge proof at all. If you just look at this.
So this is not a zero knowledge proof. This is the issuance process for a credential that supports zero knowledge proofs.
What it's worth, the process that we designed around RFCs was intentionally designed to support multiple suggestions and formats. So for example, if people see this as too complex, it is perfectly valid to come in and offer a less complex solution. And then we can figure out how to merge these two together over time. In credential issuance, we are going to want probably one protocol only because it's a core value proposition of the entire ecosystem. But in something like a ride-sharing app, you know, I have no expectation that that's going to be true.
Could I offer potentially a simplification? I think perhaps... the credential offer, when it is a ZKP-based credential being offered, if the credential offer message declared that constraint and declared, you know, what we're offering, what the issuer is offering is a ZKP, then the message you have to respond with is some form of, a message that deviates from a normal credential request, because in a normal non-ZKP based, the offer would be optional and you could just skip straight to the credential request in terms of a JSON LD or a JWT based credential that's signed in its entirety. You can go straight to the credential request and get the credential. Perhaps we need to explore the intersection of credential exchange outside of ZKPs to look at what the common elements are and the overlap in the messages.
So I can,
yeah, if you look at this, the credential proposal is from the holder to issuer. It's optional and would not be needed, for example, for if the issuer is offering it or if it's not a ZKP. Credential offer is needed from issuer to holder if it is a ZKP, but not if non. And then these two are the only two necessary for non-ZKPs. So, I mean, both of these would be optional in different scenarios. And then it comes down to the last two.
So I want to clarify something. So when I've been looking at the Verifiable Credentials Working Group, okay, they have this idea of issuer attributes. These are metadata about the issuer and the credential, right? So the issuer inserts, say, like some expiration date or a revocation registry reference or a cred ID. And then there's what's called the subject attributes. These are the attributes that are actually going to be signed by the issuer, right? So the only thing that the ZKP part adds is a third attribute called blinded attributes. These are ones that only the holder knows that are blinded before given to the issuer. So in the credential offer, I don't see why that pertains only to ZKPs because, you know, digitally, if I'm going to get something, I want to know what it is I'm getting. So I want to say yes or no. I don't want just the driver's license division to just say, hey, here you go. And then I wasn't available to accept it. And now there's this crazy credential that has my information on it out there.
Yeah.
So you don't envisage a scenario, Mike, sorry to cut whoever off, but you don't envisage a scenario where I could just go straight to an issuer and ask for a credential and specify some of the information I want.
Sure, sure you can.
Issue it, so there's no requirement for an offer there.
So the offer doesn't have to be there, I guess, but it would be nice. But what I'm saying is it's not a requirement for ZKPs only, right? For ZKPs, the only part that needs to happen is the issuer and the holder need to basically agree on some kind of factor that the issuer trusts. So like some connection to get a nonce or some other information such that the prover or the holder can't maliciously insert data and cheat when he's signing data, right? That's the only requirement. If I'm not blinding any attributes, I can just say, yes, I accept it, right? Or I can go straight to the issue. So what I'm saying is I think the flow is fine whether you're doing ZKPs or not. The only part that gets more complicated is if you have to blind the attributes ahead of time, but that should be defined somewhere else as what type of credential this is. Is this a ZKP supported credential or is this not? And that should be defining it, but it shouldn't affect the protocol that much other than what information is actually done in the offer and the proposal.
So I don't disagree with what Mike just said, but I just want to maybe agree with it with a second example. I think that offering might be relevant even for non-ZKP things because of the phenomenon of payment, also because of the phenomenon of terms of service or consent kinds of things. I don't think that those can be ignored. We have been ignoring them mostly up till now in all the kind of cool demos we've been doing, but in the long run, the process of getting a credential today in the physical world often includes something like, I go to the driver's license division and I say, here's the, I want a commercial driver's license. I don't want a normal one. And I want to put a motorcycle endorsement on it. So here's the extra fee that I have to pay so that there's a motorcycle endorsement on my license or whatever. I kind of think that offering, even though we want to ignore it, is a real thing.
I'd be curious for the people who are not working with ZKP-based technology right now and who've implemented credentials, what your thoughts are based upon this recent discussion and explanations.
So I think my viewpoint of it is actually is just this one step upstream, which is really is that and I think it's maybe more for the holder presenting, doing data authentication. And in the case of age over 21, I'm presenting my self-signed credential to the issuer for them to accept and then issue me a credential of age over 21 without any fancy ZKPs in there. So I think I'm just still missing it's just one step upstream that can be added to this decision tree.
Why wouldn't issuer take your self-attestation as truth?
Because I'm presenting it. So I think it's presenting it offline or the issuer is the DMV or it's a physician. So
presenting outside of the credential, that outside of this digital credential.
You're matching my photo and you're taking my in my hand and actually taking whatever external attestations, let's say a physician. So the issuer in our use case is a physician issuing the credential for age over 21. So the physician is the issuer, the patient is the holder. They already have some pre-populated data that they have and they're presenting it to the physician to basically attest and create a credential that is age over 21 in this most simplest form along with a photo.
Yeah, I may add something to this. I'm Oliver from Uport. This is actually also very similar to what we are doing and what we have implemented in some projects, especially in the City of Zug project. So we provide their city ID and there the holder has to go to a web application, apply for a city ID. So it will provide self-attested claims about himself, like first name, last name, and also some out-of-band identification means, like the ID card number, then shows up at the registration office in person, and then the officer there will check the ID card and then issue a claim to the user. And how we are doing this technically is, so in order to provide the data about himself initially, so this pre-populated information, the user connects with the government by providing its DIT and whatever is necessary in order to establish the communication later on. So in our case, it's also some sort of some keys and push token in order to send the push notification. And then the clerk or the officer at the municipality would then just send the credential signed by the municipality to the user using the keys provided during the initial registration step. This is how we are doing it.
Yeah, and same here. That's exactly the workflow, which is that the issuer can then accept, create a credential, and it could be zero knowledge proof if necessary. But me, the holder, or the patient as the holder, actually like looks at that and accepts that credential offer. That basically, yes, I had to give you my full name, my full date of birth, my my photo. And then the issuer generates a credential offer, let's say age over 21. And then, but if they create one that is age over 21 plus my home address, no, that's not what I wanted. I just want age over 21 because I want to buy alcohol. And that's now where I can accept that offer. Did the request to the issuer. Then there's a credential proposal, and I could accept that or not. So that's I think this piece is missing.
I'm noticing a core distinction here that I just wanted to highlight. I'm not making any differences or anything objections to what you guys are saying, but I noticed that with what you guys are describing, there is an out of band communication, and I'm not sure if that aligns with the thinking of when you're doing fully automated credential issuance. I couldn't give a good example of this right now, but what I'm thinking is like, what happens when a business is trying to issue a credential to another business for like a purchase order or something like that? And that we don't want basically people that are doing all this checking and stuff, but rather we pre-program the logic of how to handle this, and agents are just firing credentials off at each other without any human interaction.
Go ahead.
Oh, you're probably going to say the same thing. I think if you stretch the analogy, even in that situation, right, there's out of band conversation with the partner corporation. You need to verify that that's their name and who you deal with and so forth. So I think it does hold up, although you're right. You know, when you talk about, you know, like business to business or, you know, widget to widget, it becomes less pronounced.
Yeah, pretty much. To me, it's exactly the same. They would have done a presentation. So this other column of sequences to get whatever credentials they had as prerequisites that they would want to verify before they're willing to issue a credential to the holder. So they would act as a verifier first, and we've built this in the things we've been doing. We call them issuer verifiers because almost invariably they need to verify a credential, and once they have verified that, they issue a credential. So they would just go through this sequence two sequences, a protocol to do a presentation and then a protocol to do the issuance.
And it could be done at the same time as well, right? I can prove who I am, but I can also say, if you're going to sign a credential, here's my blinded attributes as well, ready to go. There's no security risk in doing that in one step.
What you think about is like an issuer really deals with two types of data. It's data that has been attested by somebody else and they need to verify. So they're acting as kind of the good housekeeping seal of approval, then know your customer. And the other is information that they generate internally so that they self-attest. You know, I gave this person a diploma. I performed this procedure on a patient. I fixed this particular car. Those are really just sort of the two things that they do.
Yep, exactly.
So there's two things we're talking about, two approaches. And one is the, like, you know, there's an out-of-band process. I'm going to give you a credential. And then you might request a different credential because you don't want the first one I gave for some reason. Like, it include the address, not just, you know, a Boolean flag of over 21. Then we have the flow that we've been talking about here, which is more of an explicit flow. And it allows for a variety of things. It allows for coordination of payment. It allows for a passing of a zero knowledge proof, cryptographic elements, for example, like link secret information, and sort of pre-configuration of what you're going to get in a way that actually allows you to verify what it contains when you get it. So there's almost a short form and a long form of the flows that we're talking about. And it feels like the folks currently doing the short form have no interest in the long form. And I suspect that that's mostly true in the beginning, but for example, when it comes time to coordinate payment for the thing, if you're trying to do the payment in band, now they're going to end up with something that looks a lot more like the long form. So what that leads me to believe is that we should either have a bunch of optional steps of this protocol, or we have a pre-protocol that you would go through that would, and then you would follow it up with the short form one. So you could have the sort of the initial protocol, the setup phase, if you will, and then you have a complete phase. And the complete phase is the fast form of the thing, meaning you just assume everything's going to work. And that way, folks that don't have any interest in any advanced use cases, like, you know, pre-coordination or ZKP link secrets or payment, could skip right to the short form if they so desired.
Yeah, and it's not that I'm not interested in the long form. It's just that the use case, the physician is not going to be handling cryptocurrency payment channels that is going to be out of band. So I'd love to support that in the future, and I don't want to discount it. But I think it's I just want to keep it simple, elegantly simple solution to get traction and minimal viable product.
I completely agree. But it's worth mentioning these are the technical messages exchanged, not necessarily steps that the human has to be involved in.
Yeah, let me use that as a segue to go to something else that I think would be relevant to the folks that are from other communities on this call, and that is, this is kind of what the message looks like and there's a bunch of information about, you know, how the type came to be formatted like that, but basically this type is just got the message family and then the message type. So this would be credential exchange, and the type would be credential offer. So that's what this specific one was. We've got a unique identifier for this message. This field is supposed to go away. This is indie specific, so it would go away. Basically, there would be a comment that would be available, and then a credential preview, which would be a list of name value pairs for essentially name value pairs that would allow you to have a preview of what the data would look like. And then this is kind of, and the idea we've had inside the indie community that we've been talking about, and this is what I'm interested in sharing with the other communities, is this is an attachment. So it is, think of it as an attachment to an email. And the idea of it is, this would be an array, and the credential offer would be able to say, well, I have a UPort version of this and an indie version, and I would have two elements in this array. And this would have, the first one would be the indie version of it with any data that is specifically known to indie. There could also be a UPort version, for example, a credential based in UPort, and it would have whatever information is needed there. And it would be up to the other side to decide which one, A, which one they wanted, which credential they wanted, and B, understand how to get it and what they would have to do next to get it. So the concept here is, this is generic information regardless of what the credential format is. This information is flexible, and multiple formats could be supported in here. Does that make sense? And do you think that could be workable in, you know, and you don't have to answer on the spot, but that's one of the main things we wanted to highlight in here. So down here, this is specific information returned from Indie SDK and the how Indy works, and this is the cryptographic properties that Mike Lauder was talking about. But obviously, if this agent didn't support Indy or didn't offer Indy credentials, it wouldn't have to have this particular attachment and, or this information.
Yeah, another way to say the same thing is that we're trying to decouple the protocol from the specifics of a format and say that there's a common sequence that we go through. Formats can be revved. They can have versions. You can support 7 different versions of the same one if you want, or you can have 3 different formats, whatever. But the sequence, the protocol that we dance, is an independent concern.
Excuse me. Vipin again. I want to go back to Oscar's proposal to rub out those two messages. The other thing is what Mike Lottis said, that if it's not ZKP, it'll still contain some payload that's relevant. I'm wondering, can't that be in the credential itself? Why should there be an offer as a separate thing?
I mean, this is the back and forth protocol to get a credential. So the body of the credential is a different thing.
So I can tell you 2 reasons. One, for example, is that if there was payment involved in receiving the credential, you'd have to have a way of doing that. And so an offer can contain the payment information. In the case of a ZKP, the offer must precede the request.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the ZKP.
Right, but we have to make sure that we have a protocol that allows for ZKPs.
Yes, but what I'm saying is in the non-payment case and without the ZKP, you have those two things become optional, right?
They do.
Let me just jump in here. Vipin, you wouldn't want a flow where somebody walks in and says, I'm interested in getting a security clearance, and the first thing that happens is they get a security clearance. There's responsibilities that are conferred upon the holder of the credential. You need to know what you're getting into. You cannot just say, well, all information about this process is transferred in the credential itself. Step one, we're done. I think that's going to lose the ability to give consent. It's going to make the process not transparent, and it's going to cause people to be committed to things they're not ready to commit to.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I'm not saying that you should take off those two for every exchange, but make it optional.
Well, they already are optional.
Yeah, they are optional.
Credential offer is not optional according to you, right?
No, you can just send the request message ID. You can jump into a protocol at any point in time because they're asynchronous.
Well,
they don't have to follow a certain flow. You may hear out.
They do need to follow a certain flow logically, but there's 3 that we're talking about. One is that you start with an offer from the issuer to the holder. The other one is you start with a proposal, could be renamed, from the holder to the issuer. The third entry point that makes sense for this is to just start with the request. If you already know everything that you need to know, then you start with the request, and then you have a credential transfer back to the holder, and that's it. So those 3 possible entry points support, I believe, every flow. And if you don't need the advanced use cases, then those aren't flows you need to support.
Right. So in the case that Jonathan's talking about, or what Vipin is proposing, I would assume you would just start by sending a credential request and get a credential back.
Okay, that wasn't clear. That's the only reason I brought it up, because currently you just added all that stuff, right? The optionality of the first 2 things.
I think we should highlight this in the hype, because this is going to be some very important tribal knowledge.
Yep.
Well,
so if I think right now the arrows for, if you actually do have a credential request, it doesn't look as though that there's any backwards flow to. Yeah, so I think it's just the diagram has to change. If that's a valid entry point, and the holder is able to request a credential, then that might work.
Yeah.
Yes.
one of the things that, and maybe Daniel, this is a good one to use to move forward to the RFC process, because one of the frustrating parts here is that we've had lots of updates, but the hype itself has not been updated, and there's a bunch of things in it that are, you know, need to get updated. If we put this in and accepted the pull request, we could get more updates on it. That would help. So maybe this is a good one to move into the streamline process.
Okay.
I would like to divert this conversation a little bit. If we're rounding it up, it sounds like we are.
Well, we've got other things on the agenda, so
it's relevant.
That should move to a different one.
It's relevant to Credential Exchange.
All right.
How long is it?
Who knows? This may be a rabbit hole that we don't want to chase down right now. But the in the credential offer, there's a comment section. And Oscar pointed out today that we want to make sure that all information contained within these are semantically valid with very good security concerns in mind. So let's say, for example, I'm offering a credential of a driver's license or something like that. And in that comment section, I say, I'm the official DOT when I'm actually not, and you start sending me information. This comment section, because it doesn't have any, it's semantically arbitrary, could be used as a point of, I would say, maliciousness for phishing somebody, depending on how the agent interprets this comment.
Yeah, but we already debated when we did invitation in the connection protocol.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same assertion. And we said, okay, great. Let's remove it. And then what happens? You get an arbitrary message. You don't know if it came from Alice, Fred, Joe, or Bob. How do you have something that is human context that you can link to this message?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Down to the responsibility of the implementer of the UI and UX to basically communicate the intent behind it. I mean, it's similar to how we browse websites today. And if we're not careful, we'll fall into the same conundrum we already have with HTTPS, where people see a green lock icon in a browser and they think, oh, cool, I'm with the official such and such. And so we need, it's kind of the role of the trust framework and reputation and that sort of stuff to validate the information you are receiving from another party for a secure channel.
Or maybe you could require them to give a verifiable credential to prove who they are. I think that's really where we're trying to get, right?
Well,
yeah, that's a good point.
There is context in this exchange, you're right, that proves that. But the other thing that we can and probably should do is in the RFC itself, describe the user experience handling of that comment, so that you know, and specifically highlight that the UX differentiate between other relevant information and the comment that's actually presented.
Basically, it's a kind of an integrity check on the message, right?
Well, not really, because it could say anything, and it could say something that's totally in conflict with the rest of the message itself, but it gives the user a chance to see something that actually relates. But the user needs to understand that what's presented in the comment field is not why they should trust the message. They should trust the message because it comes over a connection that they've already validated in other ways. For example, with a presentation of proofs. So we should definitely I think that concern is a valid one, Kyle and Oscar, and I think we should highlight that within the RFC to guide UX handling of the comment. And then I think that's sufficient, given the other context this will happen in.
That seems
sufficient. The other
I'm curious if Oscar feels the same way. If not, let's not dive down this rabbit hole too much further. We can take it offline.
I think that for the time being, this is okay, but more thinking needed.
Okay.
The other thing that I'd recommend that those new to the community come and look at, or new to the conversations look at, is there is a hype on basically internationalization and different ways of handling that. I don't think we've really settled on a happy place for that yet. It's got some ideas, but it needs work. So it's got some mechanisms, but it's not clear how those would work is the way I would look at it. So I would definitely recommend people take a look at that. So there would be, in theory, a decorator that could go on comment that could be used for internationalization. And that is, you know, potentially another attack vector from a security perspective. And also, but just the whole mechanism of how that would work is challenging. So recommend at some point people take a look at that when they're ready. But for now, I think this one is a super important one for the, especially for folks joining in. It would be really good if we can get credential offer, the credential exchange working in a way that could work across all implementations. All right. With that, we switch over. I'm going to stop sharing, Sam. We are now at 23 minutes left, so we don't have a lot, but I think you're up next with Agents Without Endpoints.
Sam, you might be muted because we're seeing your screen, but we're not hearing any of your golden tones.
What I said was totally genius, and now I got to think of it again. You're right, I was muted, and I appreciate you pointing that out. Okay, so endpointless agents. We could consider that they have an endpoint to receive a message, right, using the standard DIDCOM stuff. But and that endpoint would be what's pointed to in the DID document. We have a series of agents, though, that are endpointless in the sense that they can't receive inbound messages in the traditional way. And there are three classic cases of this. The really obvious one that most of us are interacting with is a cell phone. They can receive push notifications, but push notifications can't actually send the message. They just send a quick note that says, there's a message, you should go get it. So it's worth mentioning that push notifications are not an answer to this problem. And I'll address that further, how push notifications are involved for responsive apps. There's also some static agents. You might have an agent that is not constantly running, that starts up, does its job, sends or receives messages, and then shuts back down, but is not generally available to receive inbound messages. And then you have agents with firewall issues. You may have an agent that lives behind a firewall that doesn't allow for inbound communication, and now that agent has trouble receiving things. So these are the use cases that we're looking at. The phones, though, I think is the more relevant for the current projects that are going on, but the characteristics are very similar between them. So there's additional advantages to just solving those specific problems. One is that if we do this correctly, it brings us, I have a quoted sync to async, meaning you have a mental model that developers that are used to interacting with maybe REST type interfaces or request response can actually understand a little bit how this actually happens. It's also efficient. You can reuse existing connections between agents. If Alice needs to send a message to Bob and Bob already has a connection to Alice, then Alice can reuse that connection without having to stand up another one. So even in the case of something like WebSockets that can be held open, this is still there's still an efficiency aspect. And then it avoids all sorts of network issues. And I'll get to that in a minute as well, how that actually shows up. So there's a handful of different factors in actually communicating or getting messages to endpointless agents. I'm going to dive into each of these, but we have how this affects the DID doc, how a response message is actually communicated to that agent, and then how those mechanisms might be used for inbound routing generally. A DID document, if you don't have an endpoint, you kind of can't tell the other party that you have an endpoint. So one of the things to discuss is, how do we do this? Do we explicitly say I don't have an endpoint, or do we just not include one? And that's one of the discussion topics. But the basic idea is, whatever we do, it needs to be well understood that this means don't call me, I'll call you. Even if you have things to tell me, hold on to them until I show up and ask for them, and then I'll give them to you.
Hey, Sam, just a quick question. Isn't the service endpoint a requirement of the DID document? Oh, and now it's optional?
Yeah. You just don't have a service endpoint. Okay. But that's one of the things. But what we could do is come up with a schema.
Sam, you got a question.
What's the question?
I just heard Oliver talk. For those who are new, sometimes you just got to interrupt, Sam.
Please do interrupt me.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you. I just wanted to mention that in Uport's case, the did ether method doesn't have a service endpoint, for example. Just that's because Aries is supposed to be a ledger agnostic and probably also a did method agnostic agent, as far as I understood. We should definitely consider that there are did methods that don't have a service endpoint.
Yeah, very, very good.
Yes. So there's some discussion about whether we just whether there's an implied meaning if there's no endpoint there, or if there is, or if there's something explicit that we'd want to put into a document that meant the same thing. I don't intend to have the conversation right now. I'm just trying to highlight the various things that we actually need to talk about in the community and figure out. There's also response messages. How, for example, if I'm calling out to send a message, if Alice calls out through a firewall to send a message to Bob, and Bob has a response message, the design that we have is asynchronous so that it can be protocol agnostic, or transport agnostic rather. But if we do that, then we have to have a way to actually get the message actually back. One proposal that we have is the return route decorator, which describes a decorator that indicates that the current inbound connection can also be used for outbound connections to the same key. And so that would be a mechanism of making this happen. This implies, the whole situation implies temporary message holding, meaning if I want to send a message to an agent that I can't send directly and I have to wait for them to call in, I'm going to have to hold on to that message. And I thought, but really, if we're going to have reliable delivery, we kind of need something like that anyway. So say, for example, I'm sending a message to a DID that has an endpoint, and I try to send the message and the message doesn't succeed. Like I don't know if the message was there, maybe the connection timed out, or there was like a no route to host or something else that happened. It sort of makes sense that we would want to design our software so that it could hold on to the message and like try again in a little bit. And by the time you do that and you design a reasonable architecture to try message redelivery, you sort of have a little bit of a temporary queue anyway. The only difference is that the actual time you're willing to hold a message for someone who's supposed to call in may be a little longer than your retry delay, but the same mechanisms actually are in play there. The third thing here is that if you figure out how to talk from one agent to another and get messages back, you now have a situation where you can ask them to route for you. And this has come up in various conversations. Don't worry, I have a diagram in just a second, but this is how it works. We have two things. We have an agent, the endpointless agent, and the other agent. And the other agent is one that is fully capable, has an endpoint, is what I mean by that. So the other agent has an endpoint and is willing to route for the endpointless agent. The route destination is that queue that we talked about, and whatever mechanism that shows up, or however we indicate that that's the point. The endpointless agent calls in to get messages. It might do that on the course of sending outbound messages and then receives inbound messages at the same time, or it might specifically call in with a message or even a no-op or something saying, hey, I don't have anything for you, but if you have anything for me, I'm ready to receive. And then ideally, that other agent is also capable of understanding the push notification mechanism if it's a cell phone and not one of the other options, so that it could actually trigger the app to call in and retrieve those messages. And so there's a couple of advantages of having just that other agent do it. The cool thing too is that as soon as there's a relationship between the endpointless agent and this other agent that acts as a routing agent, now the endpointless agent can arrange with this agent to route and present its routing endpoint to other people. Meaning no other agents need to understand how to send a push notification, or no other agents need to actually hold messages for that agent in a queue. Only this particular routing agent does. So here's the diagram.
Sam, sorry to interrupt you, but I was told that I'm allowed to. Could you go back to the previous slide?
Yep.
We are talking about agent and other agents. Are these all the agents that are associated with the same DID?
Not necessarily.
Okay, that's...
It could be, but it's not a requirement.
Well, the reason that I'm asking is the thing that you seem to be doing here feels a bit like reinventing the wheel. I mean, leaving messages somewhere. We know how that works with email and POP, etc. So are we making yet another messaging protocol with message stores?
There's definitely overlap between other patterns and how this is done and what we're proposing. The advantage of this is that the mechanism is the same to move a message over something that needs to be queued versus something that doesn't need to be queued. And so the transmitting person, or the transmitting, the originator of the message doesn't actually have to understand all of the steps along the return route, and it's a fairly simple process of doing so.
So I have a question. If it's supposed to be a sort of unified API or / protocol for both routing, for both communicating through a routing agent or directly to the agent, why doesn't the receiving party's DIP document have a service endpoint then? Like, how is the sender, first of all, going to discover the routing agent?
So there's two different DIP docs in play here. There's the DIP doc that the endpointless agent presents to the other agent in this case. That one doesn't have an endpoint. As soon as endpointless agent communicates with other agent and they agree that other agent can be used as an inbound route, then on the DIP documents that the endpointless agent actually delivers to other people, it does have an endpoint. It has the endpoint provided by the other agent.
Questions, Sam. So does a DIP doc ever actually not have an endpoint? Because I thought this disaligns with our thinking around every domain requires a routing agent, which would then need an endpoint. Because otherwise you can't get inside the domain.
Yes, but the routing agent doesn't have to be a user-specific cloud agent, as we've discussed before. You can have a domain of one agent as long as you have a routing agent that will send a message into that one agent for you.
Okay, I see.
So
this is turtles all the way down.
Yeah.
So
I think,
yeah.
So hang on a minute.
I think one of the important things to call out here in terms of the DID doc the routing agent has for the phone, being an edge agent that doesn't actually have a true endpoint, the two options there are the behavior that we don't put an endpoint in the DID doc the routing agent has for the phone, or we put in an endpoint that points to an internal message queue. Like it has a scheme instead of HTTP, you have like a scheme like inbox and an inbox ID. And it basically tells the routing agent when it goes to prepare a message back to the phone, it looks up the DID doc for the phone, finds the endpoint inbox and sends. And basically then it just has a transport dispatcher registered to the inbox scheme and says, what this means is I don't actually send the request anywhere. I just insert it into local memory in a place that the phone can retrieve it.
Yes. So here's a diagram. We have phone, and the phone can only call out to the what I'm calling the routing agent here, right? And it can only call out, but it can get messages back via some mechanism, possibly via return route, and says, hey, I'm giving you a message, but I'm willing to receive a message in return over the same exact connection. That mechanism would work for both HTTP is a common thing that we've talked about, but it would also work over something like a WebSocket, and that would work just fine. Then a routing agent can actually have a normal endpoint communication style relationship with any other agent. Or a multitude of any agents, but I just included one here. And then when a message actually arrives back at the endpoint that was presented in the DID doc from the phone to any agent, it's going to arrive back here to the routing agent via the routing mechanism that we talked about at IW in other conversations. This one knows that it can't directly send it to the phone immediately, and so it queues it up and ideally sends a push notification to the phone. And then when the phone does call back in, which could, even with a push notification, could be later. I mean, if the phone's out of batteries or something and it has to be charged up before it can be turned on or something, then it might be a little bit. Then it'll go ahead and get the message. So it is exactly like SMTP. There's a point here, though, in that the other agents don't actually need to know how exactly it's being transferred along the way. And so the concept of sending a message from one agent to another agent is the same. It's pretty simple. But being able to transfer it along like this. So there's two, this diagram involves two separate things that we've talked about. One is how the phone can talk to the routing agent. A separate but related issue is how the phone can use the routing agent to receive inbound messages from anyone else. And I think it's actually worth slightly separating those conversations. Because if you solve just the relationship between the phone and the routing agent and how they're able to communicate, then it is possible to use that relationship to leverage anything else that you want. So, and it doesn't really change anything.
Why don't you just use IMAP and SMTP? Why do you have to invent new protocols that just replicate exactly what we need? Just have a spec that tells how to wrap a DITCOM message in an email, and you're done.
You could, except that now, if that's what I did, then any agent would, in addition to maybe HTTP or WebSockets, would now have to know how to send a message via email instead of the normal way it's actually communicating.
Well, no, the IMAP part you can reuse. And of course, the SMTP thing you can reuse as well. But I think it was Kyle that told me that it's very easy to interwork. So you just have a DITCOM blob that's coming in, for instance, via HTTP. And then it's put on the IMAP server. So, but at this moment, I would think let's just reuse IMAP. Let's not reinvent a new protocol that has exactly the same properties.
It doesn't have the exact same ones.
The reason it doesn't is because every single protocol is specifically mapped to its own protocol with its own port and things of that nature. So for example, SMTP always runs over a specific port. HTTP always runs over a specific port. And what we're saying is we want a transport agnostic protocol. So I would venture to say that yes, we are inventing a new message protocol, which is probably the scary thing to most people, but it's because there is nothing that is transport agnostic.
Well, the problem is that as soon as you invent a new protocol, then that new protocol is your new transport, and it's no longer transport agnostic. The whole point is we can reuse a lot of existing protocols. So why not
do that? Foster, could you? I would assume SMTP has lots of characteristics and lots of features that we don't need as part of this. That would be my reaction to that statement. So if you think that we could take a portion or the whole thing, I don't understand how it would be useful in this case.
What you would need is an interworking specification that tells how you put a DITCOM message in an email such a way that with IMAP you can retrieve it. That's all that you need. And then you can just reuse existing IMAP implementations and you're done. It's just an interworking thing.
So the objection that I have to this is that if I do so, and the phone provides a DID document to any agent in this case that says that they want to receive inbound messages via that manner, then it requires any agent to speak that specific transport protocol. Transport protocols only exist hop to hop between agents, which means that this might be a WebSocket and this might be HTTP, any agent only needs to talk to a routing agent via any compatible protocol that they share, for example, HTTP. And even if any agent doesn't speak WebSocket, that's might how it gets back to the phone. So if we were to introduce, you could use email to transfer messages to get around this problem. But there's some significant advantages, I believe, in having something that is much, much closer to normal transport of messages anyway. The things required to actually support this relationship are quite thin and very simplistic, but adds some really powerful capabilities that also exist in other protocols like email, or I know that you have a proposal, an RFC in for passing messages over XMPP, but which also would solve similar problems, except that what I don't want to do is bring all of the baggage of mail handling and processing and make that a requirement of any agent that wishes to communicate back with the phone.
Well, not
I think agent, I think another it, important it, it, point. Sorry,
any,
I think
any
another
agent
important
can just implement whatever it wants. I mean, if we have an interworking with spec with IMAP, doesn't mean that every phone shall use IMAP. No, we can have thousands of interworking specs. Some phones do better with XMPP, some do better with IMAP, some do better with SIP.
It forces a natural centralization, though, natural centralization point around people who speak certain protocols, which will basically create a service where you're re-centralizing your network by doing this. Whereas when you go transport agnostic, you can keep the decentralization property because there's no incentivization point to push everything over a certain protocol, which is only spoken by certain servers and certain agents.
I think that your argument has only meaning if you can specify, and let's not do that here, what you mean by transport agnostic and decentralized. I think email is very decentralized. I run my own email server.
So I want to just say that I've actually implemented this diagram using exactly IMAP and SMTP. I've actually written an agent that does exactly all of the stuff in this diagram. And the only thing that's missing from it is the dotted line that says push notifications. IMAP does not allow push notifications. But I would say that just because I implemented it doesn't mean that everybody else has to implement it that way. If a particular routing agent decides, yeah, I'm going to offer store and forward capabilities, and the way I'm going to do it is over an IMAP channel, that's fine. And if another routing agent says, yeah, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it only over HTTP, that's fine too. What we'd like is to be able to describe the responsibilities of the routing agent and how it communicates to the phone, such that whether you're using IMAP or HTTP or WebSockets or something entirely different, the protocol at the level of application messages is identical.
Oliver,
I agree.
Jump in, because I know you were going to say something. I'm trying to act as a facilitator for all the new people because I recognize that we dominate the conversation a lot of time.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, okay, whatever protocol we choose, we should keep in mind that these agents could run in a browser, it could run in a web server. So on a browser, it's specifically important to limit, to keep to watch the size of the implementation itself, because it could run on a mobile device as well, of course. And I've never implemented SMTP so far and IMAP, but I could imagine that they have a lot of features, as we heard earlier, which might end up in a much, much bigger library or code base that would be needed. And also furthermore, I don't know if SMTP has limitations on the cryptographic algorithm, which we could use, since SMTP is quite an old protocol. And yeah, that's just my few thoughts that I have
So Oliver, thank you. Steve, you had a comment? Your hand is up?
Yes. So as I'm listening to this exchange, I see lots of pros and cons on both sides. One issue that I'd like to kind of point out for future thought, we don't have to solve it here, is that for those of us who have applications that are size constrained, we're talking about putting in a lot of protocols into the library that would be linked in. Are we going to have a good way to filter all that out and reduce the binary?
I mean, I can't answer for the entire community there, since that's a community question. I would like to point out that what I'm proposing we do here is not some brand new transport. This is literally using the same message stuff that we're talking about using for any other agent, but simply including some communication at the application level, no matter the transport, that actually enables this behavior to actually happen. So what I'm proposing here is not some brand new thing in addition to HTTP. This is simply including a little bit more information in the application layer of messages that enables this behavior to actually work. So this is not comparing this and saying, well, we're creating something new just like IMAP is not quite a fair comparison, because what we're proposing is very minor additions to agent messaging that would allow for a phone and a routing agent to actually talk to each other in the situation where the phone can only reach out to the routing agent using any standard transport. So that could be WebSockets or HTTP or anything else. And so my desire is not that we have 60 million new transports. I want to have the minimal set of transports that actually make sense for the use cases that we have as a community. And then we also have the ability to adopt newer, better ones as they come online. George?
Oh, sorry. Hello?
Yes, your hand is up.
Oh, yeah. I'm already engaged with Stephen Curran. Who am I speaking to? Sorry. Is this Sam?
This is Sam. Yes.
Oh, yes. Right. The thing is, I'm still wondering, like, why are these agents, the documents, have no service endpoints? Because it doesn't. And I asked this earlier on, and I understood your answer to have been no. They will not have service endpoints for some reason. I didn't understand. Then I was cut off, and there was a lot of back and forth. So I don't know.
I can take that one. This is Stephen Curran, similar name to Sam. The basic idea is there's a DID doc shared between, or DID docs. There's a peer-to-peer relationship between the routing agent and the phone agent, and that is basically. Those two are working together to get messages to the phone. This routing agent actually talks to many agents, everyone that this phone talks to. So the phone will have a DID doc peer-wise relationship with each agent of the two pairs, the phone and any agent. There could be, you know, 1,000 people they connect to or entities they connect to. All of those messages flow through the routing agent. And all of them use the peer-to-peer connection between the phone and the routing agent. So the routing agent knows that the phone has no endpoint, and it uses that information and then uses this return route procedure. And then the phone tells everyone else, all these other any agents out in the world, that, hey, if you want to talk to me, my endpoint is this routing agent. Does that make sense?
No, I think further clarifications are needed.
Okay, so
can I try? I was doing the annotation here. You see the two circles?
Yeah.
You notice that there's an arrowhead on one side and not on the other?
Yes.
That's why the DID doc doesn't have an endpoint, because there isn't an arrow going back the other direction. There's no way for the routing agent to call the phone directly and send a message. And because of that, the DID doc that the phone shares with the routing agent, not the one that's over here on the right between the routing agents and any other agents, but the DID doc for this asymmetric relationship doesn't have an endpoint.
Phones don't have a way to send a message to them directly. You can't HTTP post something to a phone. That doesn't
work. So I have further observations. I think we probably need to take this offline, particularly because we're already past the end time for this call. But I still don't understand.
But George, I think that the point that came up earlier was the idea that the DID document exposed to everybody else does have the service endpoint, right?
Right.
But it's pointing at the routing agent. Yeah.
So it's the routing agent's DID document.
No, it's a DID document for the phone that it passes to any other agent, but it has prearranged with the routing agent to use its endpoint as its destination, and then the routing agent knows how to forward the message.
I didn't quite catch that. This DID document is for the phone, is owned by the phone agent, but
the DID doc represents the entirety of agents that are used. But the routing agent and the phone need to have some form of communication that does not exist in the DID doc, which probably exists as a routing table, is how I thought about this 5 months ago and haven't thought about it since.
So the phone basically uses like a virtual endpoint from the routing agent. Tell you what, let's drop onto the Aries channel and talk about this there, because we are over time.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
And I could jump immediately over there and continue that question, because I think I can explain this pretty clearly. Is there anything else that we need to address before the end of the call today? Sorry, Stephen, I'm doing your job. I'll shut up.
Hey, this is the Sam Show. I think that's the call for the day. So we are indeed over. So let's wrap it up. Take it over to the Aries channel on Rocket Chat, Hyperledger Rocket Chat. And other than that, we'll be back next week with
or
more
GitHub
topics.
Issues. GitHub issues would be a good place for this so that they can be indexable and to a broader community.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
See you, folks. Thanks, all.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.